Hello, and welcome to Inconvenient Chats. Today we'll be talking about business and human rights again. I have the pleasure to be joined by Salma Huwerbi, who has spent nearly a decade working on the topic across various organizations and countries. We've previously had one Inconvenient Chat about why businesses should care about human rights, but maybe the much harder question is, how do companies actually do that successfully in practice? And that's why I was so happy to get Salma on the board as someone who has years of experience of doing exactly this. I really loved the conversation and I hope you will too. As always, if you have comments or topic recommendations, you can write to me at kaiser@inconvenientchats.com. Let's go to the episode. Welcome to Inconvenient Chats.
Hi.
Today, I'm here sitting with Salma Huwerbi. Welcome to our online studio.
Thank you, Kaiser.
Welcome. I'm so happy to have you here. We actually, we've already tried to record this two times and now we've had to postpone. One of the reasons being that you lost your voice.
Yeah.
But now I can hear you very well, which is obviously nice for a podcast.
Indeed.
Salma, you have worked in business and human rights for the past 10 years with or at organizations such as the UN Global Compact, International Labour Organization, the Danish Institute for Human Rights. So you have a long journey and a lot of experience working with business and human rights. You're not here today to represent any of these organizations, but as someone who's worked in the field for a long time and has a personal passion for a topic, I know that you also write a lot about these topics as well. And what I think kind of like what that or how that passion was illustrated was also in the way that we two met each other.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was... like, I don't know if you can remember that, but it was like maybe 1.5 years ago. I first met you when you were giving a little presentation on the new Trump administration's DEI kind of like backlash policies at this like small and informal business and human rights network where we were maybe, I don't know, 7 people sitting in a bar on a Thursday evening. So yeah, to me, that's like a beautiful little illustration of like, you know, the passion and care that you feel towards the field.
Thank you, Kaiser. These are very kind words. Of course, I remember when we met. Yeah, I don't know if the group is still alive. Maybe we need to make it alive again.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a really good follow-up from here. And also another reason why I'm really excited to have you here is because, and why I really wanted to invite you to Inconvenient Chats was because ever since the podcast was started, for me, this question of how human rights are treated and work with in business has been, I think, one of the most interesting inconvenient topics, I think, especially from the logic of a business case applied to human rights, because that kind of at first can feel a bit controversial, at just like a bit complicated, to say the least. I've already done one episode on like the exact topic and the theory around it, so listeners can go and check it out. But what's really cool today when I get to speak with you is that I actually get to have the view from someone who's been working on the field. So not only theorizing about what ought to be, but also what works and the different kind of ideas that you've been able to develop as you've been out there. Because it's not really easy.
Yes. Thank you again and welcome to all our listeners.
Before we go into the topic itself, I'd also like to understand a bit about your journey, Salma. It's like you've been nearly a decade working across business, human rights and sustainability. You've been in different countries, in different organizations. What first drew you into this field?
Yeah, good question. I think, okay, so as you mentioned, I grew up in Tunisia and I think I also grew up in Tunisia at a time, it was right after there was a lot of the uprisings across the Middle East. and North Africa. And I think one of the most defining public debate at that time that led to the uprisings in that region was really around the relationship between business and state. And I think for me, at that time, there was a strong recognition that the private sector was really important for creating jobs. And we were all about, we need to create jobs. But there was also equally important questions around which economic models are we going to choose going forward? And how do they really benefit people? And I think for me, when I think of business and human rights, essentially, this is what we're talking about. It is about this tension, you know, what are the responsibilities that businesses have beyond creating employment? And how do we really balance sort of competitiveness with social outcomes? So I don't think I knew it as a field per se. But when I discovered it, I felt like it was trying to answer some of these questions that had fascinated me on a personal level.
Was there ever something or someone that really inspired you to step into the field or a specific experience?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I think, I wouldn't say like a person per se, because I think I kind of like stumbled up in business and human rights randomly. But I think I do have a very, I think my first work experience. So one of my first or earlier work experiences was with Better Work Jordan. And Better Work is basically a program that is run by the International Labour Organization and IFC, so the International Finance Corporation. And it's basically a multi-stakeholder initiative that brings together factories, brands, and governments to improving working conditions within supply chain. At that time, we were looking at the garment industry, and I was sort of hired to develop the program's gender strategy. And I spent a lot of time visiting factories and speaking directly with workers in that exercise. And it felt like, you know, the frameworks and the policies that I was kind of studying in schools finally made sense or had faces. And I think that experience was really like, it's quite forming, because it shaped some of my thinking that I still kind of carry today around the importance of, you know, how do we really center the humans in whatever policy or process that is designed by companies
that
could be. And I think the other thing that was very interesting about that is, because it was a multi-stakeholder initiative, there was a lot around the complexity of like value chains, you know, you could see, you know, what the brand wanted to implement versus the reality versus the government. Like, you could just see all that complexity in practice. And I think, again, didn't necessarily have maybe the language that I think I met later in my life, but I think I could practice it before I could, know the frameworks. And that's,
I really like that story, because I think it also really well illustrates, as you were saying, who was it that this work really is about, and just those workers and those like local communities and all the people in the value chains, and often, I guess, in our works, because I also work in the sustainability field, we talk about things such as governance frameworks, due diligence and such, and you know that sometimes those terms can easily kind of lose the essence of the work in a way.
100%. Yeah, I think that's something, especially now, right, with all the reporting requirements, and I think it's so easy to lose track of why is it that we're doing what we're doing. And I would say that is one thing I've also been reflecting on. Like, it's very encouraging, of course, that there's a growing uptake of legislations, and it's also extremely encouraging, I think, that there is more and more sophistication in this space, that you have companies that, you know, are also investing in having big departments in human rights, and that we're really specializing as we go. But I would say maybe one of the things to watch out for is, how do we really keep centering the humans? And also, how do we become better at measuring impact, because I think we've been focusing a lot on process, right? So we've done a lot of progress in terms of supporting companies with developing policies, due diligence frameworks, reporting requirements, but what extent do these really translate to better outcomes for workers and communities? And I think, I think that's really the question that all of us working in the sustainability space, maybe we want to ask ourselves, like, what difference did this make for workers and communities? And how do we keep centering that as we go about these processes, right?
Such a good point. Because you were mentioning this professionalization of the field. What is actually your take on, if you contrast this field, you know, 10 years ago when you started and now, where do you see the biggest evolutions? How has this field developed, and what are you most excited about also in those evolutions?
Yeah, good question. I think for me, the biggest progress has really been around, I think the space has moved from the margins to becoming sort of more mainstream. And I think that's really something that we should not undersell. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. And I think 10 years ago, maybe the conversation was more about whether companies even had responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And today we're discussing how that could look like, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think another big success of the field is that we developed a shared language, and we should, and I think that's also fundamental in how we set expectations, right? So having a shared language where concepts like due diligence, leverage, remedy, stakeholder engagement have really penetrated these corporate rooms and are now widely understood. It's pretty huge. And I think another thing that personally maybe excites me is that I at least what I observe is that there's also a growing diversity of voices who are not only shaping the field but also challenging it. And I think that's really great. If we think of like civil society organizations from the Global South, you know, it's also like they went from documenting impacts to also bringing perspectives about what effective implementation could look like, to also challenging the field completely and saying this is not working. And and I think that diversity and richness, and that's also, again, maybe points a bit to that what I was saying around like how that contributes to perhaps grounding us even more in the realities of that is based on the ground.
Yes.
If you have more and more diverse voices speaking. So I think these are all things that excite me quite a bit. I don't know if you asked me about what excites me, right?
Yes, I mean, yes. You. Yes, I'm going to ask you about what frustrates you too. but before we get into that, I was also wondering if you remember still the type of tasks that you're working on, the types of questions that companies were asking in the beginning when you started versus today, because I could imagine that with this professionalization and with, in a way, mainstreaming of the topic, companies have become much more mature, which is great, because you kind of need to start with that awareness and you need to start with that knowledge. But is there something kind of like,
whereas
in the type of work that you do as well as you advise companies and organizations?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I mean, I think we've also probably also observed this yourself, Kaisha, from your role. But I think in the beginning, there was a lot of emphasis on the why. And I mean, we are still talking about the why. I think we spend a lot of time, at least in, I mean, I can speak quite a bit about like the Middle East and the Africa region as well when it comes to that. I think we spend a lot of time trying to build the case for the why, so why the company should do it. Mm-hmm. And I think now we are still talking about the why. The why got much more complex, and we'll talk about a bit more about that as we talk about the business case, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I think now the question we get more and more is also how, and or think there were like no thinking at that time, or at least in the beginning, I don't think we were really thinking about, you know, own operations, right? So if we were thinking about how to do it, it was mostly focused on workforce. I think now there's much more focus on supply chains. There's also questions, again, because the field is more and more sophisticated. I think there's been a lot of knowledge also that went into companies that are now asking the right questions about how do we do it? How do we center rights holders? How do we work with others? What does it mean to have a true local approach? All these questions, right, that no framework can answer. And I think that's really fantastic to see.
Yeah. And I think that tells you a little bit like what is the definition of success when you're working in this field, because maybe there is no one right outcome. It's also a lot about the how. This is also something I know that you've written about. I read one of your blog posts.
Yeah, interesting. That piece I wrote in relation to the how. And I think the central argument for that article, we can maybe also link it
we'll add it to the show notes.
Yeah. I think the central argument is that how companies position an issue internally matters as much as whether they work on it or not. And I think for gender, it's so clear. And I would say it applies to other topics. But if an issue sits on the margins of an organization, like a stand, let's even like take a step back and not even think of like social issues, whatever issue that sits on the margin of an organization as a standalone initiative or something that depends too much on individual champions, it will like struggle for attention. Yes. It will struggle for resources and it will not be clear in terms of accountability. But if we want something to be taken seriously, has to be embedded into governance, into serious processes, into risk management and decision making. And I think that's, again, to go like I was talking about how we should be careful that it doesn't become too much of a process. But here I'm also arguing that it has to be a process, right? Yes. Like,
because you have to have both.
Exactly. And I think that's really important. And I think BHR knowledge can also borrow, like I find the intersection of, you know, that whole normative scholarship that relates to BHR with organizational change to be really useful. Like because we often assume that if we can prove a business case or if we can persuade people about something, then change is gonna happen. But I also think a very interesting question is how does change happen and what can we learn from other scholarships also? Change happens when incentives are set up right, when there is governance, and when accountability also evolves. So how do we think about that as well?
That's fascinating. We'll get to a few of those points also later in a bit more detail. But since I asked you what excites you, are there also things where you get a bit frustrated that there hasn't been more progress?
I think maybe relating a little bit, or like I'll expand a bit on what we were talking about. I think I worry that we've become much better at measuring process than impact.
Say a bit more?
Yeah, like for example, I manage a big program. And I think what I notice is that from the private sector, which is great, there's a huge focus on, you know, having like KPIs, on having the right process also in place. But I don't think the extent to which these processes are actually translating into better outcomes for workers, communities, and other rights holders. Like our KPIs, they're proxies sometimes, right? And to what extent are those proxies really translating reality, especially as when we think about due diligence, we think about it as a process. It's not about perfection, right? It's really about having learning and improving over time as well. And I think sometimes when we try and translate that into like a process, it could it could lose the linear aspect of it and become a bit more like every year we're reporting on X, Y, Z. And then our indicators are sort of what stories are those indicators telling us, and to what extent do they really make a difference for workers and communities. So I think that's one area that it's almost like, again, going back, like the process is important, but I don't, and it's important that it's consistent, accountable, and transparent, but it should sort of remain as a mean to an end and not the end itself.
Yeah. That's a really nice way of putting it, where you kind of need both, but you need to keep in mind what is the end goal.
Yeah. Yeah. Another thing that I was thinking about that also frustrates me, that's a little bit off, and I wouldn't say it's a frustration, but it's more a bit about like what next. I think we have done a lot on BHR, but sometimes we tend to focus too much on what companies can do individually, and I think due diligence is one mechanism of change, but there are probably many levers also beyond the UN guiding principles per se. So I think it's very interesting to think about the other drivers that can support change. And there may be many that are worth exploring a bit more. And instead of thinking, is it public policy? Is it worker voice? Is it, I don't know, is it finance? Is it public procurement? Maybe it's a bit about thinking about how do all these levers sort of work together to have the greatest impact in a specific context, if you see what I mean.
Mm. Are there any specific tools or mechanisms that you would like companies to explore more beyond due diligence?
Yeah, great question. I think I might not be thinking about it just in terms of like what a company should be doing, but actually I'm thinking, yes, exactly, that's what I was about to say. I really love the example of Rana Plaza. I mean, Rana Plaza being a tragedy per se, but what happened after Rana Plaza, right? So Rana Plaza was it's a building that collapsed in Bangladesh in 2013. Many of our listeners are probably aware. It's really a true tragedy that also became a sort of turning point for the global garment industry back then. Mm-hmm. And one of the key developments was around the accord. So this was the legally binding agreement that was signed between brands, unions, governments, factories. And it's almost like there was a whole ecosystem of actors that worked towards addressing a problem. So, and I think in that sense, I think this was possible because many actors were pushing in the same direction. Government strengthened oversight, trade unions gained power, civil society documented issues, investors asked questions, consumers were appalled, and brands also recognized the need to change. So I think to answer your question, I think there is something around what could be done collectively, you know? So there's a lot that could be done within an individual company from like the due diligence process. But I also think there is a bigger question about what intervention model would work based on which actors are there, and how do we create basically an environment where change happens. And I think in that sense, like the global frameworks are very useful, but we also, like if we were to replicate that experience, I don't think we could, the same experience, you know, replicated in Tunisia or in Latin America, but we need to think about what role each actor has and how can all these actors together drive change. And it's almost like maybe the company, maybe it's also a bit about moving beyond your own like room to thinking about that ecosystem as well. And how do you engage with that ecosystem?
I think that's a brilliant point that you can't necessarily replicate the same type of ecosystem model or ecosystem consultation model from one location or one geography to another, because, you know, depending on the, I guess, depending on the location, depending on the industry, your supply chain,
yes,
your local communities, you're always going to have a little bit of a different type of ecosystem. But the idea of thinking in terms of the system that you're a part of and the different leverage points and different stakeholders in that system is like a broader way of looking at it.
Yes, I think you say it so well, very much so. And I think this is again when due diligence or I would even say legislation give us a very good common direction in terms of how to look at these things, but then understanding local institutions and relationships and sources of influence is really what allows us to design whatever intervention. And again, it's almost like, let's even take a step back in sustainability. Like whatever intervention, right, that would have to be designed would need to consider that, right? So it's yes, kind of important to map that effectively. And yeah, and to think that there is no one size fits all. And it's not all this worked in, I don't know, in here, maybe we try it elsewhere. But you can take some of that thinking, exactly what you said, like around the process and how do we really make sure that there is an understanding of local institutions? How do we center the people? A lot of that could, it's the same output, but that won't necessarily look the same way in how you get there. And that's what's exciting, no?
Yeah. And maybe, you know, since you were talking about how the field has evolved from looking at your own workforce and now looking at your supply chain, looking at local communities. And so maybe the next step can be looking at, you know, your kind of ecosystem more broadly and also embedding that notion of what are the relationships and the power relationships and you know, those different types of kind of, you know, how do we all relate to each other? Because I think even now in the way that the EU regulation mostly treats these types of like stakeholder aspect, it's very static view of, you know, who are you connected to? But maybe we are hopefully getting more towards the how are we connected to and how do we work? What is the dynamic that we work in?
Yeah, I love it, especially from like, you cannot, like if you work on gender equality, you cannot not work on gender equality without thinking about power and power mapping and power relations. And,
yeah,
and I think what you're saying is just so, so accurate. And I think hopefully it is the ambition over time. Like, how do we really, move beyond like static sort of categorization, right? And build that in more. And I think there are already some really good examples, actually. I know there's quite a bit that's been done on, if you look at like DFIs and especially around like the independent accountability mechanisms of DFIs, they've issued some really good there is some really good guidance around that, like what do we mean by stakeholder engagement also, and how do we do it in a way that is because ultimately, it's also about that. And I think sometimes in BHR, when we talk about stakeholder engagement, we think, we mean stakeholder engagement up, but stakeholder engagement is also rights holder engagement, right? So I think as we flesh that out, what could that look like? And I think there's also ways in doing it, like you don't want to fatigue, right? But there is a way of doing it like in a way that is strategic and also optimal for a company, because we know that people we're working with are also oftentimes under-resourced and so how do we really strike that balance between this deep work but also optimal work?
And that's actually really, really good point, and probably something that most of the people who are working, you know, part of the organizations and have these on their plates that they really need to balance with. And I mean, now we've kind of like, I think we've been now been able to go through a few of the ideal things of what we would like to see. So, you know, centrality of the rights holder. So the people that this work is really about. You mentioned now this ecosystem view and the systemic view. You also mentioned the how things are done. Yeah. So how there is a process and how things are embedded into the structures of the organization. But let's talk about that other part of the token that you also mentioned. All of these requires resources, and that's maybe often also the challenge that at least traditionally social rights work has been confronted with in an organizational context, especially, for example, now when, you know, there's a lot of volatility in the world, companies are cutting cost across everything. How do you think about the value creation strategic view, of course, without undermining, again, the ultimate ambition, which is that social responsibility and rights of every human part of these value chains?
Yeah, I think it's the $1 million question. but yeah, I think,
yeah.
Yeah, I think there are two things here. I think, yes, it's true that there's a lot happening in terms of, volatility in the world. But I also think some of the challenges we're exposed to are so imminent that it's also already forcing us to think differently about things. And I mean, right now we're in Europe.
Yeah.
I guess we've all been following what's happening with fires and heat waves. And so in a way, it's almost like, I think we were talking about all these challenges as like all challenges of the future for a long time. And I think now, I mean, they're there. So I think we're dealing with them, whether we want it or not. Like and it's like how we're dealing with them is something else. But there's action. Inaction is also action, right? So I think that's just like maybe a meta thought on where we're at. And I think that's one aspect. I think there is also something about. Maybe we go back to the business case a little bit here, but I think more than ever, like when I was younger, I would maybe have thought that, you know, the business case would dilute the ethical argument for human rights, up to a certain point. But now I think, especially nowadays, it's important because it's often the language that enables these conversations within companies. So if we need it. Yes, and different and again, if we start with what we were just saying earlier, that different incentives work with different people to create change, and you have to map them, then we know that the business case functions to a certain extent, and if it can be used to build internal action, then that's one aspect. And I think that's another thing, not to be discouraged also. And then I think if you're a company, I would also, because I talked a little bit about, how sometimes we can, like, we want to make sure that this exercise or this agenda doesn't become pure reporting. I think I would really think a lot about that. Like, how do we make sure that the resources are allocated where you need to allocate them, And ultimately, like, reporting is the if you do your due diligence, your reporting is easy, right? Let's it's almost can we think about that? Can we think about the fact that we're doing due diligence and then as a result we're reporting? And can we translate that in how we allocate resources? And when I mean resources, I also mean time and energy and so on. So yeah. I don't know if I'm answering some of your questions, but yeah.
No, I think it definitely does. And I mean, we're not really, I think we've been working for long enough in the field to know that there is no silver bullet. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Have you had Have you had experiences in when you've been working with different companies where they've been able to maybe, like, you know, flip from that kind of burden, compliance, reporting, kind of like, I guess, more negative connotation with this work into something that where they've been able to then leverage it more strategically and change their view, change the way they work with it, and then also change the value that they get out of the work?
Absolutely. I think there are countless examples of that. There are countless examples of I'm trying to think. Yeah, there's certainly countless examples of companies who have done it like that. I think it's, again, the moment it really becomes a strategic priority and the moment it really sits within that area of work, then it is ultimately around that. I mean, we've also seen, and we know that many companies take the sustainability agenda also quite seriously and at a high level, that you also see them engaged in multi-stakeholder initiatives, that, you know, they even move beyond the individual sort of positioning to also doing work across sectors. And I think there's many examples where, I mean, again, especially for sectors that are high risk, I think there are countless examples of that. And I think it necessitates, I think, a backup, a strong backup from leadership. And I think it also necessitates for the agenda to be strategically positioned, right? I think that's really important.
I would also argue that it would require some kind of consistent efforts and at least, you know, some kind of medium-term commitments from companies. I don't know if you would agree with that. And that, you know, even if we like to talk about KPIs and we like to know relatively quickly whether our investments have been quote unquote worth it, there are oftentimes for topics like this, would also say that it applies to like research and innovation, product development. You often need to kind of stick around for some time, and only after do you start actually, you know, realizing the real value, because also in this case you need to build those relationships with your stakeholders or your rights holders and start to understanding them, building that relationship, making that into, again, like building that into an ecosystem instead of kind of doing like a one-off thing and fixing. It's not really a fixing thing, maybe it's more like a thing that you should be doing continuously.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, I mean, I also started by saying earlier on that we need to remember that it's a process, and we need to remember that it's about improving and reflecting on what doesn't work. And it is not a one-time fix. It's not a linear sort of like, oh, you do it once and you're done with it. And I think a lot of times when we think about work in this field, sometimes I think that's the risk, that we really are thinking about it from a quick fix mentality. But in reality, sometimes, yes, you need to invest to reap the benefits also later on. And also, I think if we go back to the philosophy of the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, it's really about disclosing what doesn't work as well, right? And making sure that it's addressed. It has never been about perfection. It has never been about, this is a perfect process and this is, we are like, our supply chain is free of any issues. Like, it has never been about that, right? So, I think if we really think that, then it is long-term work and it is actually forever work, as long as company activities exist, kind of, in some ways, right? Like, you want to minimize them, you want to do no harm, you want to make sure that, but in essence, there has never been the expectation that it's, you know, it's about remedying to what isn't working. And that's, again, maybe remedy being another forgotten pillar, like that maybe needs, how do we activate that? And again, it's circular and it is a journey.
And what about then situations where human rights work maybe does make doing business harder?
Yeah, good question. Okay. Yeah, I think this is again, on the business case, because I talked a little bit earlier about how important that is, especially in this climate where there's more and more pushback, and how it can be so useful in making the case internally, and I think that's definitely the case. But I also think, yeah, as you said, there are cases maybe where I think this collusion is also, it's a bit about when you see it and how you see it, and what time frame do you take to look at the collusion, because I think first this is when regulation also becomes essential. If we go back, to what I was talking about, there's state, business, society, kind of like the three actors. I think commercial incentive is one incentive, right? So if respecting human rights always doesn't align perfectly with the commercial incentives, then it's almost like then we wouldn't need regulation if it was always aligned. But that's also why we need regulation, because that's why you have three actors. But I also think we should not be short-sighted in thinking about that, because I think in many situations, regulation is interesting because it also changes the competitive landscape. So it's almost like then companies who are doing the right thing are not disadvantaged for doing it. And in some ways, it creates a more level playing field where the respect is an expectation over time. So maybe it collides today, but it will not collide over time if with the right regulation, and then it becomes an expectation. And I think that's something, yeah, really to think about, instead of, yeah, thinking always about the collusion. Yeah, I don't know if that makes sense. So it's almost like the business case is there to help companies understand how they create value and gain traction, but regulation is also there to provide guardrail when the market incentives are insufficient. But also, ultimately, it will lead to better economies because we're leveling the playing field. So let's think long term here.
I think it makes perfect sense. And again, it's a good reminder of how we kind of need all of these different parts of society to build these systems that really work for the purposes that, we kind of set for them.
I mean, one thing I also really, I shared this with you already. One thing I always think about when I think of the business case, it's actually gender equality, because I also don't think the existence of a business case is necessarily yielding to action. And I think a great example is gender equality, because there's decades of evidence that are showing that more gender diverse organizations perform better, innovate more, attract talent more effectively. But we also know that progress is much slower than this evidence would suggest. And I think this is again a good example to show that maybe evidence alone does not change behavior, because it could compete with other aspects like systemic barriers, power dynamics, organizational structure, and like inertia. And again, maybe you need different layers because one alone is not,
Exactly. I wonder, since we've been alluding to, like, there it matters how do you do things. You need to remember to, center on your rights holders and engage them in the right way. Do you have like a top three, top five, something like the no-brainers that you think all companies should make sure to do because it's like an obvious thing that they should be doing, but maybe not everyone has thought about it.
Ooh, great question. I think study the context is really important. So that would be one thing that I would always think about. Speak with, if you can, speak with rights holders, speak with their representative as much as you can. And when I mean representative, I mean it could be civil society organization, it could be National Human Rights Institution, it could be anyone who can speak on behalf if it's very difficult to have like that direct engagement. What else? Make sure that you have a plan. Know who your stakeholders are. And also, whenever you engage them, know why you're trying to engage them. For what? I think sometimes there's a lot around, like I was even thinking about it in another different context, but you know, when you do consultations, I think a good consultation is also one that makes use of the knowledge that stakeholder group has. So thinking carefully about the design of that. Like you could, because you could, you know, you could have a consultation where you bring everyone, but then nothing comes out of it because you're not asking the right question to the right person. They might be a good question for someone, but maybe not for that person, right? So I think thinking a little bit more about that. And I think one very like simple thing that I would also encourage all of us to think about is how do we make sure that whatever like plan that comes out of corporate rooms is accessible and to people, including rights holders organizations. So making sure that your plans and action on sustainability are public, are accessible, are easily findable. I think that's a very simple thing that could also create like do a lot in terms of fostering transparency more broadly. And yeah, I think I don't know if that's maybe more than three.
That's great. You're also answering to what will be the typical pitfalls that companies would do when they are doing the work, but they're maybe not leveraging it for the full value that it could potentially have. You mentioned this reporting aspect and making sure that all the things that can come out and the contents of the work are somehow easily accessible and readable. Interested to hear your view on, CSRD, so the EU reporting regulation that, yes, has been changing over the past year, but many companies have already started reporting on their sustainability efforts, including everything that they do on the social side. Have you found that the CSRD reports have been, this type of resource, like that would be easily accessible, or what would you like to see instead so that it could be even more accessible?
No, I think it's fantastic. I think it's a great step. And I think we already see some work of like civil society organizations that are already looking at, you know, analyzing that kind of reporting. I mean, I think that's also the logic that we should be heading towards. So I think it's great. I think we'll also need a bit more time to like figure out and like discuss and look at like what the impact of these legislations really are in terms of like people again. But I definitely think it's a fantastic step towards transparency. And I think another thing, I mean, but yeah, you're also probably very well aware of, Kaisha, is how do we harmonize that reporting? That was also one of the value add of having that. I remember when I was working with the Business and Human Rights Resource Center, we were doing a lot of work around, you know, benchmarking companies and looking at these reports and trying to study like the secondary data that company produce and you know the fact that you don't have those harmonized reports could also be really hard to analyze. And I think having that common framework is again one step towards the right decision and the right like collectively advancing responsible business. And I think then it also creates opportunities for companies because there's a lot around how do we learn from each other, how do we share with each other, and maybe that's also a bit undertapped. And I'd be really curious to see how that will evolve in the future as well.
That's a really good point, and I think another good example of how you can, leverage something that maybe can easily be viewed as like a compliance burden, into something that actually yields some very insightful insights. We're heading towards the end, of our time here, but I wanted to ask you now before we head off. After almost a decade working in the field, what keeps you motivated? What keeps you hope? What gives you energy?
I think it's conversations like these, I have to say. I really think I enjoy them. So thank you very much for that and for the invitation
Thank you.
to your podcast. I'll keep following. I think it's fantastic that you have this space to take a step back and think and reflect. And I would say conversations. And I think what keeps me motivated is really curiosity, because every discussion that you have with a company, and every company is different, a trade union, an investor, or civil society organization. It's almost like they give you like different perspective on the same challenge, and I think that's one thing that I really find exciting about this field, that there is like no single actor has a whole answer, but how do all these pieces sort of fit together?
You've told me that when you started your career in, and as you've been working in the field, you've been really fascinated about different questions. Is there a question that you're still trying to answer?
Oh, I think so many. I think the more you answer a question, like I feel like every question brings 15 other questions, right?
Yeah,
but
that's also
but
true. So true.
I think yeah, I think yeah, maybe I think if I had to like think about it, I think when I started, I was really interested in looking at what does responsible business look like, and now I'm more interested in thinking about how do we create conditions for responsible business to become sort of the norm? And I think by that I mean, yeah, it's a bit what I was telling you. How can this ecosystem of actors contribute, and how do dynamics differ from one country or a sector to another, instead of just being sort of prescriptive that this is what you should do? I think I'm a bit more like, yeah, macro, I guess, in my thinking these days, and really also very interested in reading a bit more and learning more about like other scholarships, like the politically, it's almost like the political economy of responsible business conduct, or what could that look like? And of course, as we do that, like how do we keep what we're saying, which is like how do we keep people at the center of all of it? So I think these are questions that I'm keen to think more about in the future.
Well, I'd love to have you back then when you feel like you've had some kind of answer gathered, or at least elements of an answer. I'd love to hear more about the conditions, as you were saying, because I think that's also really positive framing for the thing, as you were alluding to before. It's not really about perfection. It's not about, everyone fitting that one certain mold, but it's more around like a mentality of continuous improvement, and also remembering what do we do, what do we do this for, and that's quite inspirational, I find.
And I think there's, again, w with the sophistication of the space and with the fact that we are heading there, so maybe I'm too positive compared to, like, I know you were like drawing the landscape for us, but I think I choose to be a bit, because we don't have choice. Like we need to think, like it's in these moments of crisis that we have to think, I guess, about what could we do differently, right?
Yeah, that's true. Thanks for that, Salma, and thanks for the whole
Thank
conversation.
you.
I'm so happy that we got to do this, and I hope that maybe I'll get you on board again. We'll see.
Yeah, with pleasure.
Think I lost you for a second.
Yeah, someone called me. So that's what happens when someone calls.